Half with History. I'm Jonathan.
And I'm Kylie.
And this is a show where we talk about the upcoming week, but a long time ago.
And sometimes not so long ago.
Do we have any updates, Kylie?
I don't have any, do you?
Neither do I. Do you want to get right into it?
All right, let's dive on in. So this week, I want to talk about an English writer, traveler, political officer, administrator, and archaeologist.
That's quite the resume.
Yep, and it's also a woman.
That's quite the resume.
Woohoo! On October 26, 1922, Gertrude Bell was appointed Honorary Director of Antiquities in the new Department of Antiquities in Baghdad, Iraq, which is the origin of the Baghdad Archaeological Museum.
Oh, neat.
Yeah. Bell played a major role in establishing and helping administer the modern state of Iraq, utilizing her travels and relations with tribal leaders throughout the Middle East. She was also highly esteemed by British officials, enabling her to exert an immense amount of power. She has been described as, quote, one of the few representatives of His Majesty's government remembered by the Arabs with anything resembling affection, which I thought was kind of funny, which, considering the British history with colonization, that's saying a lot.
Wait, did it say that in whatever you were researching?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was like a little side quote about her. And her relationship with a lot of the people she came into contact with.
That is interesting.
Yeah. Which, I mean, like, the general consensus is that most colonized places did not like the British, which, fair.
Yeah, absolutely.
but, like, I guess her particular way of, she wasn't necessarily, like, a political figure. She was more of, like, a cultural interest kind of person. Anyway, we'll get more into it.
Okay.
So Gertrude Bell was born on July 14th, 1868 in Washington, County Durham, England, to a wealthy family, which enabled her education and her later travels. Her grandfather was the ironmaster, Sir Isaac Lothian Bell, an industrialist and a liberal member of parliament. And his role as a policymaker in government exposed Gertrude to international matters and most likely encouraged her curiosity for the world, and then later, her involvement in international politics.
Fun.
Yeah. A little bit jealous of having that exposure.
Yeah.
Her father, Sir Hugh Bell, second baronet, so I guess her grandfather must have been the first baronet. he was a progressive capitalist and a mill owner who made sure his workers were well paid and cared for. Unfortunately, Gertrude's mother, Mary Shield Bell, died when Gertrude was just about three, but her father remarried to Florence Bell, who was a playwright and an author of children's stories, as well as an author of a study of the Bell factories. So, like, she studied the working conditions and that kind of thing.
Okay.
Yeah. So both, you know, like, children's stories, and then are these people being treated fairly? She instilled concepts of duty and decorum in Gertrude and contributed to her intellectual development. Florence was also heavily involved with the wives of Blackow Vaughan ironworkers in Easton, which likely influenced Gertrude's later stance promoting the education of Iraqi women.
Cool.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Gertrude attended Queen's College in London and then later Lady Margaret Hall at Oxford University, where she specialized in modern history. In May 1892, after leaving Oxford, she traveled to Tehran, Persia, with her uncle, Sir Frank Lascelles, who was the British minister, which apparently is similar to, like, an ambassador, kind of, representative
okay.
in that country. She described this journey in her book, Persian Pictures, which was published in 1894, and she spent much of the next decade traveling around the world, mountaineering in Switzerland, and developing a passion for archaeology and languages. And now I suddenly feel like I haven't quite done enough with my life.
Yeah, right? Jeez.
So during this time, Gertrude became fluent in Arabic, Persian, French, and German. And she also spoke a significant amount of Italian and Ottoman languages. Some of Gertrude's other adventures included recording 10 new paths or first ascents in the Bernese Alps in Switzerland. There's one alpine peak in the Bernese Oberland, the 2,632-meter Gertrude Spitz, which was named after her
okay.
when she and her guides Ulrich and Heinrich Fuhr first traversed it in 1901. So she has a peak named after her.
Cool.
Yeah. She also had her fair share of dangerous mishaps, with one ascent ending when inclement weather left her clinging to a rock face for approximately 48 hours amidst snow, hail, and lightning.
Whoa.
So, apparently, you get the ascent named after you, but you also almost die. So, yikes. Gertrude continued writing and photographing her travels, publishing another book titled Syria, the Desert, and the Sown in 1907. Her vivid descriptions revealed the Arabian deserts to the Western world. In March of 1907, Gertrude journeyed to the Ottoman Empire and began to work with Sir William M. Ramsay, an archaeologist and New Testament scholar. And if I remember correctly, he's like one of the big names in like New Testament archaeology.
Interesting.
Yeah. Their excavations in Bin Berkelis were chronicled in 1001 Churches, which I like that because it's kind of like a play on 1001 Nights, including their discovery of a field of ruins in northern Syria on the east bank of the upper course of the Euphrates, along a steep slope of the former river valley. So they made a nice, you know, discovery as well. Because some archaeologists will dig their whole lives and never find anything of significance.
Right.
In January 1909... Gertrude left for Mesopotamia. She visited the Hittite city of Carchemish, mapped and described the ruin of Ukadir, and continued to Babylon and Najaf. Back in Carchemish, she consulted with the two archaeologists on site. One of them was T.E. Lawrence, assistant to Reginald Campbell Thompson, but many may recognize him better by the name Lawrence of Arabia.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yep. T.E. Lawrence equals Lawrence of Arabia. Which is funny because I read that sentence when I was doing like my notes. I read the name and I'm like, why is that familiar?
Mm-hmm.
And then I clicked on it and I went, oh, right, okay.
That guy.
I'm like, oh, I feel really dumb for not immediately recognizing it. But at least I recognized it.
Yes.
So in 1913, she completed her last and most arduous Arabian journey, traveling around 1,800 miles from Damascus to the politically volatile Hayl, back up across the Arabian Peninsula to Baghdad, and from there back to Damascus. She was only the second foreign woman after Lady Anne Blunt to visit Hayl, and arriving during a period of particular instability, she was held in the city for 11 days. So not quite captive, but more along the lines of like...
quarantined.
Yeah, sort of. So in a way, yeah, sort of. More of like a you might die if you go anywhere. So good luck. So as I mentioned earlier, Gertrude held a considerable amount of political clout when it came to British activities in the Middle East. Now we're going to talk a little bit about her political career. When World War I broke out, Gertrude's request for an assignment in the Middle East was actually denied. So she volunteered with the Red Cross in France. However, in 1915, Gertrude was summoned to Cairo to the nascent Arab Bureau, headed by General Gilbert Clayton. Both Gertrude and T.E. Lawrence had been recommended by the renowned archaeologist and historian, Lieutenant Commodore David Hogarth, to be assigned to Army Intelligence Headquarters in Cairo. Hogarth had recognized the value of their knowledge and expertise, as well as their established ties with the local tribes in the area. Upon arriving, Gertrude helped Hogarth set about organizing and processing all of their shared data and accumulated knowledge about the location and the disposition of the Arab tribes. And Lawrence and the British used this information in forming alliances with the Arabs in the area. In March of 1916, Gertrude was sent to Basra, which British forces had captured in November of 1914, where she advised Chief Political Officer Percy Cox. She drew maps to help the British army reach Baghdad safely. And she became the only female political officer in the British forces and received the title of liaison officer correspondent to Cairo. So AKA, basically, she corresponded to the Arab Bureau where she had been assigned. But she was the only woman to receive like that kind of title in the period.
Oh, interesting. So,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. From what I understand, remember of World War I, very few women were really like in the field at all, let alone holding something other than like a secretarial position.
So, okay, yep.
After the British took Baghdad in 1917, Gertrude was summoned again by Cox and given the title of Oriental Secretary. So now we're on to the secretary. As the dismantling of the Ottoman Empire was finalized by the end of the war in late January 1919, Gertrude was assigned to conduct an analysis of the situation in Mesopotamia. Due to her familiarity and relations with the tribes in the area, she had pretty strong ideas about the leadership that was needed in Iraq. She spent the next 10 months writing what was later considered a masterfully official report titled Self-Determination in Mesopotamia. Although, as I'm sure you can kind of see where this is going, the British commissioner in Mesopotamia named Arnold Wilson had different ideas about how Iraq should be run.
Bah, bah, bah.
Yeah, well, and he preferred an Arab government to be under the influence of British officials who would retain the real control, because he felt that the Mesopotamian populations were not yet ready to govern and administer the country efficiently and peacefully.
When was this?
1919, right after World War One.
Okay. I was trying to think of, like, when, you know, how there's, like, a bunch of, like, historical photos of those countries being very civilized.
Mm-hmm.
So that just sounds racist. That doesn't sound like they weren't civilized. That sounds like there was some imposing of uncivilizedness to that statement.
I feel like the pictures that you're thinking of are from like the 60s and 70s before the Arab Spring.
Well, yes, definitely from there or earlier. But
okay.
I just don't know how much early, like, civilizations don't exist only for 10 years.
No, you're right.
Yeah.
I know the pictures that I'm familiar with are from like the 60s and 70s.
Right.
Anyway, either way, it's not a great opinion. In October 1920, Cox returned to Baghdad to assign Gertrude to act as liaison with the forthcoming Arab government. So she essentially played the role of mediator between the Arab government and British officials, as well as mediating between the various groups in Iraq, including a majority population of Shiites in the southern region, Sunnis in central Iraq, and the Kurds, mostly in the northern region, who wanted to be autonomous.
Yep.
Keeping these groups united was essential for political balance in Iraq and, you know, for British imperial interests, but mostly those British imperial interests.
Yeah, of course.
Side note here, we could go on a really long rant about British imperialism, American imperialism, and imperialism in general, but I just really don't have the energy for it.
I would say American imperialism is, in my opinion, more interesting than British. British is very, like, typical imperialism.
Right, yeah. British is, like, the classical imperialism.
Yeah, whereas American imperialism is, like, guerrilla imperialism, where we, like, pretend to have pretend not to have claim over pieces of land, but
and we just ship weapons and money to the, you know, people who live there who are, and like just try to back the overthrow.
Yeah.
It's
I mean, we do have more typical examples of imperialism, like
Hawaii.
When we took over like Hawaii. Yeah. Hawaii and Alaska were very typical imperial, but things like, you know, the U.S. Virgin Islands and Guam and
Puerto Rico. Oh, yeah. Anyway, because we don't want to spend 3 hours discussing
this. Mini imperialist talk right there. Just so you know, America is an imperial state.
Yes. Most Americans don't realize that. Anyway, so to no one's surprise, in modern times, running an imperial empire could be expensive. Who knew? So British officials quickly realized that the costs associated with governing Iraq the way they had planned would be pretty costly, and it would be significantly cheaper to have it be an independent state. Go figure. The Cairo Conference of 1921 was held to determine the political and geographic structure of what later became Iraq and the modern Middle East. Significant input was actually given by Gertrude in these discussions, so she became an essential part of its creation. So, like, she helped create what we consider the modern Middle East.
Interesting.
Yeah. At the Cairo conference, Gertrude and Lawrence highly recommended Fasil bin Hussein, the son of Hussein, Sheriff of Mecca, who was the former commander of the Arab forces that helped the British during the war and entered Damascus at the culmination of the Arab Revolt. So basically, he helped the British overthrow the Ottoman Empire.
Yeah.
He had been recently deposed by France as king of Syria, and British officials at the Cairo conference decided to make him the first king of Iraq. They believed that due to his lineage as a Hashemite and his diplomatic skills, he would be respected and have the ability to unite the various groups in the country. Shiites would respect him because of his lineage from Muhammad. Sunnis, including Kurds, would follow him because he was Sunni from a respected family. This, hopefully, would keep the different groups peaceful and under British control. So upon his Facile's arrival in 1921, Gertrude advised him on local questions, including matters involving tribal geography and local business, because, you know, he wasn't from there, so he didn't know that. She also supervised the selection of appointees for cabinet and other leadership posts in the new government. Referred to by Arabs as Al-Khatun, which means a lady of the court, but who kind of keeps an eye and an ear open for the benefit of the space. So not quite like spy, but like sort of spy almost. Hmm. More of like lady with an open ear, I guess, could be like a way to interpret it.
We talk a lot about female spies on this podcast.
I love female spies. Femme fatale all the way. Okay. Mm-hmm. She was also a confidant of King Facile of Iraq and helped to ease his passage into the role amongst Iraq's other tribal leaders at the start of his reign. So she helped him navigate, you know, an entirely new political climate.
That's without a lot of responsibility.
Failing. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, like, no one assassinated him. So there's that. He helped her to found Baghdad's Iraqi Archaeological Museum from her own modest artifact collection, and to establish the British School of Archaeology in Iraq for the endowment of excavation projects from proceeds in her will. So she was, you know, leaving all of her worldly possessions and money to further, like, the cultural discovery of, you know, this area.
Very cool.
Yeah. Throughout the early 1920s, Gertrude was an integral part of the administration of Iraq. So she really integrated herself into this political climate here. However, as is the case with most European imperialists in this period, she isn't completely without her faults. Historians have pointed out that the present troubles in Iraq to be derived from the political boundaries she helped to conceive that created the borders. Her reports, however, indicate that problems were in fact foreseen, and Gertrude and her British colleagues all believe that there were just not many or really any permanent solutions for calming the divisive forces at work in that part of the world, which, you know, that's a bit of like a privileged viewpoint because they're British looking at this situation and determining what they think is right.
Yep.
So that in and of itself is inherently problematic.
And again, like the comment from earlier where they're not sure if they could actually be at a point in their history where they could be a civilized nation. And it's like, how long have people in the Middle East existed?
Right. Longer than the British.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it there are definitely issues with the way the Middle East was designed, essentially.
I mean, all the way back, like way back to the beginning, because mm-hmm. like the Crusades were pretty mm-hmm. brutal on the Middle East. I feel like we other imperial countries and states had a very good hand at making sure that that region was always oppressed or under threat.
Yes. Yes. Yep. So compounding this problem of her, you know, having created these arbitrary borders, essentially, was that she lobbied for the Sunni minority to control the Shiite majority, which essentially paved the way for the Sunni dictatorships that followed.
Instability was fostered.
Yes.
Like, regardless of if they were attempting to set up a more stable state.
Right. Yeah.
They didn't pay attention to cultural cues. They didn't pay attention to actual borders. Like,
yeah.
They were just kind of like, you all play nice now.
Yeah. It's like putting mortal enemies in a sandbox and being like, all right, kids, have fun.
Yeah.
And not expecting one of them to leave crying. Her colleagues also insisted that the Kurds be deprived of a homeland, which I don't understand that logic whatsoever, and that a portion of them should be incorporated into Iraq, a division that she didn't actively oppose. So, like, by silence, she was complicit.
Yep.
The division of the Kurds between Iraq, Syria, and Turkey led to their oppression in all three of those countries. And unfortunately, she even endorsed the use of force against them. So, like, to keep them in line, essentially, which is very problematic.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, she was not the only person to hold these opinions. So, like, she's It's problematic because she's very much like a person of her time.
I'm just saying you don't even have to clarify with that. There are still a vast majority of people today who believe in peace through force.
Yeah, that's not, that's not logical. Like, you don't get to peace by beating people into submission. Yep. Anyway, in a letter from Gertrude to her father dated December 18th, 1920, she wrote, quote, "Mesopotamia is not a civilized state." So she made her feelings pretty clear. Gertrude also held strong beliefs on Zionism. She believed it would be unfair to impose Jewish rule on Arab inhabitants of Palestine. And she distrusted the Balfour Declaration, which announced British support for a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine. So basically announcing their support for the establishment of Israel as a country. So she was not for the establishment of a Jewish country, which, as far as I can tell, generally speaking across the world, that is a very, very split decision. So since I'm trying not to end on the most depressing of notes, I saved my favorite of her contributions for the end. In 1919, Gertrude was invited to be a speaker at a meeting for the promotion of a public library in Baghdad, and actually ended up serving on its library committee, and then served as its library committee's president from 1921 to 1924. At its inception, the Baghdad Peace Library, also known as Maktab al-Salam, was a private subscription library. But in 1924, it was taken over by the Ministry of Education and became known as the Baghdad Public Library. In 1961, it became the National Library of Iraq.
Oh, neat.
Yeah. Which I thought that was really cool. She was, you know, involved from the, you know, the foundation of it, essentially. And now we get back to the original topic that I picked.
Ah, there we go.
Yes, we're circling back around. Gertrude formed the Department of Antiquities in Baghdad that became the Baghdad Archaeological Museum and then later was renamed the Iraqi Museum. So it's had a lot of names. She was appointed the Honorary Director of Antiquities on October 26, 1922. And her goal was to preserve Iraqi culture and history, which included the important relics of Mesopotamian civilizations, and to keep them in their country of origin, which, let's be completely honest, that's not how the British usually treated foreign cultural items of significance.
No, not at all.
British museums would be empty.
Yes.
If they hadn't taken everything from other countries. Actually, let's be honest, a lot of museums across the Western world would be very empty if that hadn't happened.
Exactly.
So I was like, all right, that's a good thing you did. So she also supervised excavations and examined finds and artifacts and brought in extensive collections, including a collection from the Babylonian Empire. The museum was officially opened in June 1926, shortly before her death. And after her death, at the Emir's suggestion, the right wing of the museum was named as a memorial to her.
Cool.
So she has a wing of this museum named after her, which I think is very nice. So Gertrude returned to Britain in 1925, due in part to a decline in her family's fortunes, as well as impending ill health. As many can assume, factory owners didn't do great amidst the post-World War I strikes and the economic depression across Europe. So, and like, that's where her family's money came from. So shortly after her return to Baghdad, she also developed pleurisy, which is an inflammation of the membranes that surround the lungs and line the chest cavity. So she got pretty sick. And then if I remember correctly, like, she got sick, she got better, and then she found out that her half-brother had died. So, like, she got walloped by a lot of different things all at once.
Jeez.
Yeah. On July 12th, 1926, Gertrude Bell was discovered dead of an apparent overdose of sleeping pills. And there's significant debate over her death, but it's unknown whether the overdose was an intentional suicide or if it was an accident. Mm. Because she had asked her maid to wake her up. So, like, she hadn't just been like, good night.
Yeah, maybe it was, like, new pills, or she was feeling extremely bad and took an extra just in case.
Yeah, like, and it was, like, that little bit too much. Yeah, it's
not like medicine was good until the late 80s anyways.
So. And even that's arguable, yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, there's really no way to know, which is unfortunate. She was buried at the British cemetery in Baghdad's Bab al-Sharjib district. Her funeral was a major event in the area and was attended by large numbers of people, including her colleagues, British officials, and the King of Iraq, who watched the procession from his private balcony as they carried her coffin to the cemetery. So she had, you know, people who cared about her who attend her funeral, which I thought was, you know, nice.
That is good.
Yeah.
Generally, that's what you want.
Yep. So Gertrude Bell left a lasting legacy through her numerous books. And I mean, like, numerous. She wrote a lot. And her political influence. Her contemporary, D.G. Hogarth, penned her obituary and honored her by saying, quote, "No woman in recent time has combined her qualities, her taste for arduous and dangerous adventure with her scientific interest in knowledge, her competence in archaeology and art, her distinguished literary gift, her sympathy for all sorts and conditions of men, her political insight and appreciation of human values, her masculine vigor," which sort of backhand comment there, "hard common sense and practical efficiency, all tempered by feminine charm and a most romantic spirit."
There you go.
So other than that, like, masculine vigor, I thought that was a very touching tribute. But at the time, being, you know, labeled with masculine vigor would have been, like, a good thing, but...
Yeah. Yeah, I could see that.
Anyway. So in modern times, Rory Stewart, a British diplomat, travel writer, and member of parliament, noted that when he served in southern Iraq in 2003, he often heard Iraqis compare his female colleagues to Gertrude Bell in a kind of case of, like, casual flattery. So, like, it would seem that she still has a bit of a favorable opinion there.
Interesting.
Yeah. Gertrude has also been represented on the silver screen, played by Gillian Barge in the ITV television film A Dangerous Man, Lawrence After Arabia in 1992, as well as two films based on her life. Queen of the Desert in 2005, where Gertrude's portrayed by Nicole Kidman.
Okay.
And the documentary Letters from Baghdad, based on her and her contemporaries' writings, with quotations from Gertrude being read by Tilda Swinton.
Oh, okay.
I thought that was neat, yeah. So posthumously, Gertrude Bell was awarded several accolades, including being made a commander of the Order of the British Empire, a stained glass window dedicated to her memory made by Douglas Strachan was erected in St. Lawrence's Church, East Roundton, North Yorkshire, and in 2015, there was an exhibition on Gertrude at the Great North Museum in Newcastle, and this exhibition then moved to Kirklitham Museum in Redcar after its run in Newcastle, and this started an effort in 2016 to transform Bell's family estate, Red Barns, into a memorial and a museum. And my favorite part, the Gertrude Bell Archive, held by Newcastle University, was added to the UNESCO Memory of the World program in 2017.
Oh, neat.
Which is, you know, pretty big deal.
Yeah, exactly.
In 2019, entomologists studied wild bees in Saudi Arabia, described a new genus, which they named in honor of Bell as genus Belitergula, known from the species Belitergula nagica from central Saudi Arabia. So she has a bee named after her.
Belitergula.
No, Belitergula.
Belitergula.
Which is better than the Gertrude, the name of the mountain thing, the Gertrudisfitz or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. I was like, that's a problem.
I will say the bee sounds a lot like a Godzilla villain.
Yeah, it does. Anyway, so that was the life of Gertrude Bell. A slightly condensed version because she did a lot and I did not want to make this episode like 3 hours long.
All righty. Are we on to our call to action?
Call to action, yep.
Awesome. You guys can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Halfwit History. You can find our website at www.halfwit-history.com. You can help support our show and what we do by going to www.ko-fi.com/halfwithistory. And if you want to suggest a topic or talk to us, you can reach out at halfwitpod@gmail.com.
Yeah, we'd love to hear from anyone. Send us your suggestions, your topic ideas, your comments. Nice critique. Anything is welcome.
As one of my teachers used to say, questions, comments, non-complaints.
Yes. Non-complaints.
Yep.
Constructive criticism is fine. Complaints, not so much.
Yep. Are we on to... Oh, and thank you to the Fishermen for the use of our theme song, Another Day. You can find a link to their SoundCloud down in our show notes. Now Kylie does all the pointing. And I don't think I've done the pointing for like the last three episodes, but now Kylie does it because she's mocking me.
Yes. Exactly.
So just be known, listeners, that every time we say down in the show notes, one of us is pointing, either mockingly or seriously.
The world will never know.
Well, they know now, forever, because I just said that it's forever.
Yeah, but they'll never know which one's doing it at any given time.
True.
It's
true.
The mysteries of the world.
On to fun facts?
Yes.
Okay. What week did we have again?
Oh, I didn't say it at the top. It is October 26th through November 1st.
Okay, awesome. I did pick the right week.
Woohoo!
So on October 31st of 1981, the first live U.S. radio drama in over 25 years was premiered on NBC, and it was a Halloween story.
Ooh.
And if you haven't checked out our other show, we did a Halloween story this year on Halfwits and Failed Crits called Backstabbing Beasties.
Oh, yeah. That was fun.
It was really fun. It's the first episode on that podcast that we did where we actually had all the equipment set up.
Yes.
So it sounds like, really nice.
It's the first episode from Halfwits and Failed Crits that doesn't sound awful.
I know. If you haven't been a convert over to that one, that was actually where we first got our mic. I think we mentioned this on the podcast last year when
Probably.
We announced that we were doing this show too. But we got our Blue Yeti that we were using in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I bought it because I just wanted to like finally have a record of one of our games being done at all.
Yeah.
So I bought a Blue Yeti on like Amazon Prime Day and slapped it in the middle of a table with zero forethought for literally anything, not knowing how to record. Really, half of the episodes were recorded on my laptop, even though that they were plugged into the Yeti.
Yep.
I never told the program to record from the Yeti.
Yep.
Because this was all before we started Halfwit History, because we actually started Halfwit History because we had the mic.
Yeah, so we literally had no idea what we were doing.
Right, so when we started Halfwit History is when I started learning. So poor Halfwits and Failed Crits has a slew of catalog that is just god-awful audio, and I did my absolute best to learn how to master it, but Backstabbing Beasties episode, it's all self-contained, it's a Halloween theme thing, so I thought it was kind of neat that there was also a Halloween radio drama that was part of history on this day. So
I play a vampire.
Yes, you play a Celtic vampire.
Yes,
yeah. So
yeah.
You turn into a raven and
it was awesome.
Yeah,
I loved it.
Anyways, that's all for me. What's your fun fact?
My fun fact harkens back to the Bella Turgula.
To the Bella Turgula.
Yes.
What?
On October 28th, 2007. B movie premieres in the U.S. and the U.K.
Goodness gracious.
I love it.
Great.
No, I hate it.
We've added B movie to the things that we've talked about on our podcast. And
womp womp.
It doesn't feel good.
It feels so bad.
It feels so bad.
Don't watch it.
Shivers down my
again.
Spine. That's about as scary as a Halloween radio drama.
I watched that movie for like the first time, like I think last year, and I was just sitting there in abject horror throughout the whole thing.
It's such a bad movie.
I'm totally on board with the boyfriend who gets dumped.
Yeah. Yeah, he is 100% right. You shouldn't be being in a romance with a bee, with a Bella Turgula.
Being
in a romance.
Oh my God. Okay.
We
got to
end this.
Please. The ship has sailed. Let's go.
Yep. We're done. Anyways, thank you for listening. As always, I've been your halfwit.
And I'm your historian.
And we hope you come back next week.
Bye.
No. That's high.